ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Boardman, and today our guest is Nina Stepanov, Associate and Head of Platform at XLPRIZE, and we're going to talk about startup accelerators. This episode is brought to you by the UI Audit. Want to design web applications that are actually useful to people? This book will help you adopt a smarter approach to UI UX, from product strategy to each individual screen. To get your copy, head over to uibreakfast.com/audit and use your special promo code SUMMERTIME20 to get 20% off any book package. Hi, Nina.
Hey, Jane, how's it going?
Doing great. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So first, can you please tell us a bit more about what you do and a bit about your background, how you got there?
Yeah, sure. So as you said, I'm both a investment associate and the head of platform for XLPRIZE. We are a pre-seed B2B SaaS accelerator based in San Francisco and New York City, and then the summer launching in Australia. We invest really early into the enterprise tech startup scene. And my background, so I am originally sort of a marketer and program manager by trade. So I used to work for a handful of surprise enterprise tech companies, you know, in multiple different capacities, from very straightforward marketing, like email marketing, demand generation, all the way to, like I said, that program management type stuff. I helped build inbound.org, which maybe some of your listeners have heard of. And yeah, sort of a mix of different projects that have fallen into my hands. And recently in the last year, decided to transition into venture capital, which is kind of how I ended up here. So I had a brief stint at Techstars, which I'm sure many people have heard of, and am now doing this at XLPRIZE.
Fantastic.
And I specifically, yeah, I should probably clarify too, I specifically run the New York program. And then we have a team out in San Francisco that runs that program.
Mm-hmm. Great. So there's a very, like, there are different people in our audience. Some of them are very familiar with the startup world and the way you raise funding and everything, and the others are totally not. So we're going to address those that are not with this 101 episode.
Right.
So tell us about your company. What does XLPRIZE do exactly?
Sure. So yeah, XLPRIZE is an accelerator for enterprise tech companies. Mm-hmm. B2B SaaS is another phrase for what we do. An accelerator, for folks who don't know, is typically a program that runs anywhere from 3 to 6 months. Ours runs for 4 months, where the company itself invests an amount of money. In our case, it's $50,000. In return for an amount of equity, in our case is 5%, and then sets up the company to go through a program. There's a lot of different formats of that program. So, you know, there's us who run this 4 month intensive. We have all the companies come to our space and work with us for those 4 months, where we bring in mentors, you know, sort of speakers. We have workshops, we have roundtables, we do weekly KPI meetings. We really kind of set up, I guess in most cases, kind of like an office environment, but it's all different companies. So in New York right now, for our first program, we have 6 companies all doing different things, but are all under this enterprise technology bucket. And that's how we run our program, is just a structured thing. And we do one-on-one meetings with the founders to make sure that they're growing. And the whole intention is that with our investment and our support, these companies are growing much faster in the 4 month period of time than they would have on their own, right? In theory, it's something like 4 months with XLPRIZE will grow you as fast as you would have on your own in, let's say, 2 years, or 1 year, you know, whatever that metric might be. And our particular focus is on supporting in a sales and fundraising capacity. So we try to be incredibly helpful in teaching our founders how to sell really well. And actually connecting them to potential customers that could use their products, And then we also support them through fundraising. So we build this huge network of other investors and angel investors, you know, institutional investors, service providers, everyone under the sun. And we support you in as a founder in raising your next round of funding, whether that's a seed round or Series A, you know, kind of spans the gamut of fundraising efforts. You know, and then there's some of the different models of how this works too. There's like Y Combinator, which a lot of people have heard of, which does, you know, once a week, they have all the founders come in and they do sort of a session with them. And then there's Techstars, which is very similar to what we do, but it's 3 months long. You know, there's a lot of different ways to do it, but it's pretty much this sort of controlled amount of time, with the investment, and we take equity and support you through your growth. And then once the program is over, we have a demo day where we have all the companies pitch themselves and present what they've worked on and how successful they are. And they graduate and go on to sort of continue building their company, and we still support them. I like to equate it, for people who aren't in this world, I jokingly equate it to like adult summer camp
for business
founders. Yeah, so like I'm the head counselor and they're all campers and they're building their businesses, which I probably shouldn't refer to it that way because it makes it sound ridiculous, but it does feel that way, especially when it's nice outside.
Once people take your little part of investment, how authoritative are you in the program? Do people really have to oblige on your decisions?
No. So that's a great question. And I'm sure a lot of people have probably wondered this and probably stopped them from taking this path. So we pride ourselves quite a bit on being what we call founder friendly. We try to make decisions, on a daily basis, we're posed with decisions that are either in the best interest of the founder or in the best interest of us. And we almost always, 99.9% of the time, will choose to do what's in the best interest of the founder, unless it's incredibly detrimental to us. And so what that kind of transforms into is that we actually don't require anyone to do anything, right? It's kind of intended that, you know, if you're going to take our investment and you're going to come be part of the program, that you're also then going to participate in the programming, you're going to take our advice, it's the same thing as accepting an investment from anybody else. You don't want to take money from someone that you don't agree with. So in theory, hopefully, the founders that we're investing in, they believe in us and they trust us and respect us enough to take our opinion to heart. So I don't know that. There have definitely been instances, right, where founders will say, you know, we want to do X, and we'll say, well, you should do Y. And then they say, well, we don't want to do Y. And we're like, you know, we'll push. We'll definitely say, look, like, this is why we think you should do this. We have all these different reasons. But at the end of the day, it's your decision. It's your business. We only take 5%. So it's not like we have a commanding stake in the company enough to tell you what to do. It's really just kind of advice, I guess, is the best way to put it. And that's, I mean, my advice to anybody who's a founder is to always do sort of, like, you should be making a decision at the end of the day. It shouldn't be somebody else making a decision for you. They can help you and they can give you advice and they can tell you why that's the best decision, but really you should be making a decision at the end of the day.
Are there any relationships with the founders that turn sour because of such misunderstandings or anything like that? Or do you, like, guarantee 100% success rate, everybody's shining and fantastic and so on?
That's funny. Definitely. The thing is, I think what people should also just, you know, be cognizant of, and most founders are aware of this, for better or for worse, is that the failure rate of startups is incredible, right? It's one of the riskiest asset classes that you can invest in. And 9 times out of 10 or whatever the statistic might be, it's very high. The business is going to fail. So what you're really doing is sort of hedging your bets by going into an accelerator. I tell folks a lot that if you're, the benefit of doing an accelerator is that we've done it before. We've seen it before, right? And in some instances, I mean, many of our mentors have actually run companies, right? They've built, run, sold, IPO'd companies, and they know what to look out for. And so you're sort of hedging your bet and saying, I'm going to put my time and effort into this program because they can help me not sort of reduce the likelihood that I will fail.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Right. Or increase likelihood that I will succeed. Kind of, you know, glass half empty or full, however you look at it. So we don't necessarily, I mean, there's no guarantees. And I would never tell a founder that doing our program would guarantee you anything besides my love and affection for your company. But we definitely, we try really, really hard to make sure that our companies are closing customers, that they're developing products that are meaningful and actually work. You know, we definitely do our very best and put a lot of effort into connecting our founders with potential investors and follow-on investors. Our statistic right now from what I remember is 75% of our companies have gone on to raise at least $250,000 within 6 months of finishing the program. And that's, you know, I'm not sure if that's even including the companies that raise within the program. You know, cause I'm pretty sure majority of our companies right now are raising money. And that's one of our biggest value adds is we know a ton of investors, and we have really good relationships with them. And so we constantly make introductions and say, hey, you know, here's this founder, here's their business, and here's why they're going to be successful. You should invest in them. Because at this really early stage, it's a lot about the founder. It's a lot about who's behind the business and who's building it, and the product itself is super important. But you know, it's easy to pivot a product; it's not that easy to pivot a person.
Yes.
So we try to put a lot of stake behind those people, and that's, I mean, our guarantee is that we're going to work our asses off. I don't know if I can curse. That's our guarantee, is that we're going to work our hardest to make sure that you're successful, and everything else is kind of in your hands.
Which leads to the next question. Who is the typical profile? What is the typical company profile for startups that enter your accelerator? You mentioned these are B2B SaaS companies, but what's mm-hmm. the typical size? Do they have the funding of their own? Do they have a runway of their own, or are they bootstrapped for that? Or
Yeah, so it's a mix. We see typically, and this kind of speaks to the pre-seed investing arena in general, but we will talk to sort of pre-revenue and pre-product companies, but once you start the program, you should have a product. So our founders will have built something that can be sold, because one of our value adds is that we will juice you to customers. And if you don't have a product to sell, it's kind of hard, right? It's kind of being a waste of time. The revenue bit is tricky. Some companies that we invest in, they either have to wait for a specific thing to happen before they can make revenue, or, you know, they've just finished their product and are now have a strong pipeline that they are trying to sell to. So that part will vary. Our number is usually anywhere from zero to 100K in revenue, monthly recurring revenue. Mm-hmm. I'll check that number and get back to you. Yeah, typically, our founders are anybody from recent graduates to, you know, adults, like folks in their 40s with kids and families. We're pretty agnostic in terms of that, obviously, but these folks do have a product. They're typically making revenue already, and they have either a healthy pipeline or a network that they can tap to get more of a healthy pipeline. But I mean, the enterprise, what's cool about the enterprise tech space, and I think a lot of people give it a bad rap because it's not as sexy and fun as consumer. Anybody can build, the same way that we can build a consumer product, like almost anybody can build an enterprise solution, right? Most of us work in enterprise, and most of us work in tech. So it's basically just folks who've identified a problem in a business and have said, I can build the solution to solve that problem. Whether it's HR focused or finance focused or legal or whatever it might be. So our founders really do come from all over the world, and a lot of different kind of, I guess, specialties.
It's interesting that you mentioned enterprise software and B2B, because you can be B2 small business, which is definitely not classified as enterprise in my little ecosystem. Like, would you address those in your company?
Yeah, so we definitely have companies in our portfolio that are focused on the SMB market, and we have obviously have companies that are focused more on the larger enterprise market. So we don't necessarily have a preference. It's open to both. I think building a really great SMB solution also very frequently turns into what ends up being, you know, a solution for the larger enterprises as well. Mm-hmm. I think HubSpot is a really great example of that. A company I used to work for, you know, they built for the slightly smaller and now have the capacity to service the much larger. So we will invest in both. And I think, you know, enterprise tech and B2B SaaS have sort of been mixed into this same conversation for multiple different reasons, but we're happy with all and everything.
Tell me a bit how the numbers work. So you're making an investment which is $50,000, if I understand correctly. And mm-hmm. for the runway of 3 to 6 months, that's not a lot of money. You can maybe, you know, do a little bit of paid advertising or add one more person to your team, but not much. So how exactly does that scale to rapid growth? Or is it not financial, but, you know, mentorship component that, you know, leads to that?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So the $50,000, and you might get different opinions and perspectives on this. So I don't think the value of an accelerator is the money that you're getting from it. The money, actually just talking to a friend about this the other day, the money you get is just enough so that you can continue to pay for your business to operate while you basically get inundated with introductions and perspectives on your business for the duration of the program. You know, which is also the reason why a lot of our companies end up raising either a small round, like friends and family round, or a very small seed, because they need to raise the money to operate the business. Our investment is in, we're going to make a ton of introductions for you, from customers to investors to mentors, advisors, everything under the sun. And we're giving you enough money that you can comfortably be here with us in our office space and sort of utilize that that inflow, like that input. So that's how I personally look at it. And there's also varying amounts of money that are invested in from accelerators. So there's some accelerators that invest up to $150,000. For 3 to 4 month programs. You know, there's like, I know, you know, Techstars has, I think they invest like some small amount of money, and then you have the option to take on more, which is basically the equivalent of raising a small seed round. So there's a bunch of different ways that folks do this. But I believe that our investment is really just kind of, is like you said, the mentorship aspect. That's how we're accelerating your growth, not through funding the operations of your business.
So it sounds like the ultimate goal of people who are joining your accelerator is getting funded in the end of the program. But are there those who don't have that goal in mind, who just want to keep, you know, your sales expertise and marketing advice and probably a little bit of advisory relationships, but not take the funding ultimately?
I'd say people coming into the program, again, and this is something that folks should understand about accelerators, that people coming into the program, they understand that this is not, we're not bankrolling your business, right? We're not sort of giving you the opportunity to buy like a high rise apartment, you know, and live in lap of luxury. No, like we're going to quite literally inundate you with as many instructions as we can so that you don't have to figure that out on your own, right? You don't have to be at the right place at the right time to make the introduction that we've already made. That's our biggest value add. And then we articulate that when you come in and you interview and we do due diligence on your company. And that's where you see the value. So there's definitely actually currently in our New York City program, there are founders that I've talked to who are like, I'm here for the value of the intros. Like, I don't care about the money. The money is not what brought me here. You know, and if it is, like, if you're just looking for money, then you should just go raise from some, like, from just a regular fund, most likely, or from, I don't know, from friends and family, right? From your rich uncle or rich aunt. because if you think you can make the intros yourself, then why put yourself in this space for 4 months where you kind of have to be here every single day? But it varies from person to person. But it's definitely, our value is the human aspect.
Can you give our listeners a brief, you know, 101 introduction to the vocabulary of investments? You know, the seed round, the round A, and everything. Like how it works for those who are not from that world.
Absolutely, it's really funny that you asked that. I was actually at a panel event a few weeks ago, and it was four female founders talking about their companies, and they kept using this terminology interchangeably. And someone even asked, like, can you explain the terms? And no one ended up explaining it. And I just sat there in the front row and I was like, I really just want to stand up and give them a quick rundown. So, So the way this works is there's different opportunities to get funding. When you go the venture route, right? So when you decide that you don't want to self-fund your business, and self-funding can happen a couple different ways. You can, you know, money out of your own pocket, money out of your parents' pocket, friends, family, whoever it might be. Maybe you've decided to, or revenue, which is right, the holy grail, is that you actually just sell your product or service and you make money from it, and that's how you fund your business, which is a fantastic way to do business, and I highly encourage it. The other side of the coin is venture funding, which is typically where most tech companies go because of how much money you need upfront, especially to build your product and to get it to market and to sustain the growth that you need, right, to pay employees, to buy office space, to pay for credits on Amazon and all those kinds of things. And that's why most tech companies go that route. And so when you go that route, you do what's called raise money. Raising money is basically going to people and asking them for money. And these people have lots of money because that's kind of their job is to invest amounts of money in companies that they think are going to be successful. These raisings are called rounds. So you have pre-seed, which is where we sit, which is arguably the earliest stage of funding. We typically say that we're the first institutional capital into a company after friends and family, after your own money, after bootstrapping. So pre-seed is typically pretty small. It's growing the amount of money that you can invest in the pre-seed is growing. But that's just kind of an indication of the industry in general, but you know, anywhere $50,000 to $150,000. Then you move into seed, which is the next round of funding, which is, I won't give bands cause it's hard. There's a lot of, blogs out there that explain the different sizes of these rounds, and they're just changing pretty aggressively right now, so it's tough to say. Seed funding is another round of money, and then you have Series A, which is the first time that your company that's a more official moment for your company, right? That's when you bring in much more serious investors. That's when you become, it's kind of the first time that your company is actually valued. And that's, in my opinion, I kind of joke a lot with a lot of my founder friends that that's when you know you've sort of made it past the first major hump of starting a company, is when mm-hmm. you pass the Series A threshold. Those rounds are they can be as little as a couple million dollars all the way up to hundreds of millions of dollars, depending on what industry you're in. And then, you know, you go on to Series B, C, D, E, F, G. They just keep going. I don't even know where. I think Uber is probably on its like F round. Who knows? Those are just rounds of funding. And you as the founder of that company will go out and every time you need to raise money, you will do this process of pitching your company to a room of investors. And then they kind of decide, you know, I want to put in X amount of money to own X percentage or Y percentage of your business. And typically you need a couple different investors to come in together to fill out the entire round. And then you as a founder will go and say, I want to raise, you know, $3 million on a $10 million cap. And then investors will come in and say, you know, well, we need to own this much percentage of your company. And so we have to invest this amount of money for it to equal the percentage that we want to have to own. And without getting into the actual details of kind of the finances of investing, because that can go on forever. And it's a great book. Like Venture Deals is a great book to read if you're actually interested in understanding the details of the terminology and how the numbers work. But at the earlier stages, it's a little bit more straightforward. There's a couple different ways you can raise money too, like convertible notes and safes, which again, I highly recommend just reading about them online because there are lawyers who have explained it much more eloquently than I can. but yeah, is that a good overview? Is there anything I missed?
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. And one more question. I do know the answer, but it's not like it's written everywhere on the forehead. You know, what happens if, as a startup, you take a certain amount of investment, not $50, but maybe even $50,000, but more or something, and your startup fails? What happens then?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Again, as we were just talking to a friend of mine about this, typically speaking, assuming you set up your business as, you know, either whether it's a limited liability, LLC, or however you decide to set up your business, there's different varying degrees of what sort of the repercussions are for a failed business. Typically, it doesn't really, it sounds bad. Typically, it doesn't really mean anything. Like, if your business fails, you are not, like, your house is not going to get foreclosed on. You're, you know, they're not going to take away your kids. Like, you know, like, it's not the end of the world. It's not like taking on a loan in, like a student loan or a loan on your house. It's different. You know, you're creating a company as an entity, and that company sort of shoulders the burden of any investment that you take on. So, but not any investment, right? There's different kinds of investments, and there's different kinds of structures that your business can be that protect you from being personally sort of screwed if your business fails. And I think that a lot of people don't understand that concept, which is pretty frustrating because it stops a lot of people from starting a business because they're concerned about, like, well, I don't want to take, you know, a big investment from an investor and then my business fails and then they're going to take, you know, my house, my kids, my dog. And that's just not how that works. You personally are not necessarily going to be affected by, the loss of that business. I mean, there's, I forget how many, but there's a number of you know, close to 10, some maybe even 11, I don't know. So there's an obscene number of businesses that people have, successful founders have started and failed prior to being successful. And those businesses have raised money and those people are just fine. And they're not rich people, right? You don't have to be super duper rich to start a company and be successful. So, yeah.
Is there any kind of blacklist that you get enrolled into that no one is going to invest into any of your new businesses again if you fail?
No. Oh my God, that would be terrible. No, definitely not. So, we personally at Accela Prize, we love to see repeat founders, even if you've failed. You know, it's when you have, no one does anything right the first time. And if they do, it's either beginner's luck or they're lying. it takes a couple of tries. Starting a business is really hard. There's no easy way to do it. And it's really difficult and people fail countless times. And I think that it speaks to a founder's resilience. If they've put in the effort to try and fail and try again, you know, like I'd rather talk to the founder who has tried 10 times and failed than the one who's never tried and is doing this for the first time. Maybe I shouldn't say that. Well, I'll talk to any founder, but there's no hate for trying and failing. There is definitely, though, I will say, you know, venture capital as an industry is very relationship driven and everybody knows everybody and everybody talks. So what I will say is that whatever it is that you do start or you do end up working on, don't be crappy, right? Like, don't be someone that nobody wants to work with. If your business fails, have high integrity in that failure. Don't screw people over. Don't piss off your investors. Don't ignore them. You know, treat everybody with respect because that does get around, right? Because the internet exists and everything ever done is public for the most part. Sorry, everybody. You know, and people will find out. So that definitely follows you. But if you're a good person and you do your best and you try and you're, you know, do a great job at trying, then I think people appreciate it. I personally appreciate it.
That's a great, encouraging speech. Thank you so much.
That's great.
Is there are there any situations when a startup is not a great fit for an accelerator besides being able to bootstrap from your own revenue, which is, as you mentioned, a great case already?
Yeah. So a couple of different instances where it might not make sense. Like you said, the bootstrap, right? If you can bootstrap your business. Because then you're not beholden to anybody. If you have done it before and you have a ton of connections of your own, you don't necessarily need to do an accelerator. You might even need to raise money because you can make the connections on your own, right? You can sell a ton of customers on your own, which is basically by default bootstrapping. So we can talk about sort of the people who don't need to go through accelerators that can just sort of skip that step and go straight to institutional, like larger institutional investors. Those are typically repeat founders or someone who's just figured out something that is really enticing to an investor. There's always the option of just trying to pitch regular later stage investors and seeing what happens, right? You kind of try and you learn. So that's one case. I'd say there's also a couple instances where businesses are just a little bit too far along for an accelerator. I know that now, actually just found out the other day that there are accelerators that service even later stage, like late stage companies, mm-hmm. which I had no idea that existed. So that's pretty interesting. Like it's almost to say that there's no point at which your company is too old to maybe be in an accelerator, but not necessarily ours. I'm trying to think. I think it could be too early too, right? So if you just have an idea and you haven't put any boots to the ground, you haven't committed time and energy to it. There's a big debate around like, should you have quit your job to pursue your company full time before you go do something like an accelerator, or even like consider an accelerator, which is a tough topic. there's an earliness factor of like, if you haven't figured out what it is that you're actually going to do or how you're going to execute on it, then you might just be too early.
That's great advice. Thank you, Nina, for sharing your wisdom today. So for people who think that this might be a good route for their business, where can they go online to find more information about that? Maybe your website or any other resources?
Yeah, so two places you can go. One is our website is accelprise.vc. So accelprise.vc. You can check out sort of who we are, what we do, our mentor list, things like that on the website. And there's a button to apply. So we run two programs every year in all three of our locations. So there's kind of a crazy amount of opportunities to apply. So right at this moment, our San Francisco applications are open for our ninth cohort that kicks off in July, super soon. So you can apply through the website. You also go directly to the application on AngelList, so angel.co/accelprise, and the application will be there as well as like our portfolio and things like that. But those are probably the two places. Or find me on Twitter. I love to talk to people on Twitter. It's my favorite planet. So Nina R. Stepanov is my handle, or just Nina at Accelprise. You can probably find me. Feel free to DM me or just tweet at me, whatever it is that you're working on.
Sounds fantastic. Well, thank you once again for joining us today. And maybe this path will be interesting for someone, not just bootstrappers like most of us are here.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's and there's no harm in trying, right? There's always an opportunity. You never know unless you try it out, give it some effort. You might make a connection that changes the path of your business forever. So definitely recommend it, even for connection purposes.
Thank you, Nina, and I hope you have a great day.
You as well. Thanks, Jane. Talk to you later.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.